Chapter 4. The Orc Attack Moon. The three Thunderhawks flew into the moor. They came in low, beneath the flights of the orc fighters, and close to the port side of the jaws. They entered the throat of the monster, a colossal shaft reaching straight down to the center of the moon. Energy flashed outside the viewing blocks as they crossed the threshold. Inside the reclaimed honor, the ultramarine Simias said, "Some form of containment field. They're maintaining their atmosphere."
"You're impressed," said Corland.
"I am respectful of an opponent's capabilities," the tech marine said. "Doing less would lead to faulty theoreticals and disastrous practicals in battle."
"And what do you deduce that we don't already know?"
Hakon Icegrip asked. The space wolf had not donned his helmet yet, and the low snarl of his breathing was audible in the hold. He was taut with impatience. "I deduce that all aspects of this base are receiving large amounts of power," Simias said, unmoved by the challenge in Icegrip's question. "Theoretical? Much of the damage we inflicted before has been repaired, at least in terms of tactical effects. That is a lot of energy to devote to the preservation of atmosphere in a launch shaft." The honor shook. Proximity warnings sounded. Corland looked through the viewing block. The Thunderhawk was flying so close to the inner wall that it had clipped protruding scaffolding. The walls were crude, uneven, and they whipped by at such speed that there could be no evading minor obstacles. The three gunships were traveling through thickets of ragged ends of iron and rock. They were not taking fire yet. Corland dared to hope they had entered undetected.
"What do you think, Simias?" the Blood Angel Vepa asked, pointing to the teleport Homer on the Tech Marine's back. "Will it work?"
"I can't say. Too much of this technology is unfamiliar."
He sounded suspicious. Corland couldn't blame him. The Imperial device had been modified so heavily it was barely recognizable. It was less bulky than the standard model, but had sprouted a tangle of cables and brass spheres.
"The device is Xenos-tainted," said Haniel.
Corland turned to the Dark Angel's librarian.
"Of course it is, and we will use its taint to purge the larger one." "While teleporting ourselves back to the Herald," said Icegrip, "there isn't even a platform."
"Once powered, the machine will respond to the signal from the ship's teleportation pad," Simias said. "It is the Herald's device that will call us back, while the ones we place on the moon will send it away. Theoretically."
"Theoretically," Vepa repeated.
Corland glanced at Haas. She had said nothing since the launch from the Herald of Night. She stared out the viewing block, her face grim with pain and stony determination, as she returned to her prison. As he watched, he saw her jerk as if in bleak recognition. He didn't think it could be. She had never seen the launch shaft. Even so, at the same moment, the pilot Nithael voxed,
"Approaching primary target." "How close can you get us?" Corland asked.
"I see a major avenue. It looks clear."
"Take it."
The reclaimed honor slowed. The wall became less of a blur. Its details became clear as the gunship turned into a passageway wide enough for a battalion of tanks. The edges of the opening were broken, as if the tunnel had been cut here by violent action. The kill team shed grav harnesses and stood. The Thunderhawk came to a rapid halt, landing with a blast of exhaust nozzles. The forward ramp dropped, and the first of the Death Watch squads stormed down onto the tunnel floor. Corland led his squad and Haas deeper, while the gunship lifted off again.
"Good hunting," said Nithael. "I will await your return."
"Fly well, brother," Corland told him.
He watched the honor turn back towards the shaft. There was a glow coming from it, dark and red illumination from the engines of the passing interceptors still heading out to fight the blockade. The two other Thunderhawks should be finding their landing targets very soon. The reclaimed honor's departure was a good omen. Perhaps all three would exit the moon and return to the Herald of Night. Perhaps this mission was not completely mad. The tunnel they were in was almost wholly dark. A few guttering lumen globes dangled from cables. They were widely spaced. Between them hung the broken husks of many others.
"This region is no longer used," Simias said.
He gestured at the cables. "There is illumination here by chance, not design. The power is going everywhere. even where it is no longer needed.
But what was this used for? Said Vepa.
Wherever it begins, it leads only to the shaft. What use is that for vehicles?
The tunnel is for construction, Haas answered. They build fast. The big passages allow them to mobilize quickly.
Indeed, said Courland. Look how quickly they rebuilt after our attack.
To Haas, he said,
There have likely been considerable changes. We have an approximate location on the Auspex. Do you think you can take us there?
I haven't been there, but I can show you the best way to move around.
She moved further along the tunnel, sticking to the right-hand wall.
Here,
she said, pointing up. There was an opening just below her head height on the wall. Haas reached up and pulled herself inside. Courland and the others followed. It was just large enough for a space marine to walk in a crouch. There was no light here at all, though Courland's helm lamp picked out more tangles of cables and conduits on the low ceiling of the passageway.
I've seen the little creatures use these, she said. There's room for many of them, and these shafts keep them out of the way of the large orcs.
Vermin, said Icegrip.
Cunning vermin, Haniel answered. They will need to be silenced quickly. The point is not to bring the full horde down on us. We are coming as a shadow among the greenskins.
The space wolf grunted, acquiescing.
A shadow with teeth, he said.
Courland showed Haas the Auspex. The readings were marked by numerous power surges. Three were singled out. Two were close together, one much larger than the other. The energy source furthest away was the known quantity. It fluctuated moment to moment, winking out of existence, then becoming explosively bright, more intense than any other signal on the screen. It was the gate. The orcs had reopened it. The third kill team would close it again, this time forever. The other two targets were the ones whose locations were approximate guesses, reached through a combination of analysis of power signatures and Haas's memories of her imprisonment. Courland pointed to the larger of the two clustered targets. This, he hoped, was the attack moon's power source.
Can you find the way? He asked.
I think so. I only saw it once, but there is a kind of order to the pathways here. Things flow to and from that location.
Show us then, said Courland.
The shadows with teeth moved off. The penitent Roth dropped Thane's squad on a rough platform just outside a tunnel, so ragged it would have seemed natural if the walls had not been made of patched together stone and iron. The five space marines entered the crevice. It made a sharp turn almost immediately, then another, its path nothing more than a fault line between walls. Within seconds, the squad vanished from sight of the launch shaft. The passageway angled left, then dropped down and kept sloping downwards.
This is taking us in the wrong direction,
Asger Warfist said.
I know, said Thane. The extrapolated target was a control complex located above the presumed power source. The mission was already riddled with uncertainty and guesswork. Moving down and away from the goal only added to the frustration. Thane played his helm lamp over the walls ahead, looking for any kind of exit.
There,
said Abathar. Thane stopped and looked up at the spot the Dark Angel's tech marine had isolated. 20 meters up, where the sloping walls of the tunnel almost met, two openings faced each other.
No bridge, said Straton, the ultramarine. Do the greenskins leap over the gap in the dark?
I suggest this passage is the result of a shift in the walls, Abathar said. That tunnel is not likely to be still in use.
I think you're right, said Forcas.
The Blood Angel's librarian pointed to a spot on the floor of the fissure, directly below the broken tunnel. Three orc bodies lay, broken, smashed open against the raised, jagged edges of metal plating.
So how do we get up there? Straton asked.
Thane watched Abathar examine the right-hand wall. Its surface was rough, a contusion of folds and cracks. He fired up the plasma cutter on his right servo arm and played it against the wall. The light stabbed at the eyes in the gloom. It took only a few seconds for the cutter to melt through the stone and metal and form a rough handhold. Abathar looked at his handiwork, then back upward.
The lean of the wall is unfortunate, but acceptable. We can climb.
He raised the servo arm and burned another ledge into the wall. It took 10 minutes for Abathar to cut a ladder all the way to the top. Once inside the tunnel,
Thane found the path hewing much more closely to the desired heading. Warfist strode at his side. Though he wore his helm, Thane could sense the Space Wolf's impatience for battle in the quick jerks of his movements. He was holding himself back, though, and Thane noticed him checking on the movements of the rest of the squad, especially Abathur, weighed down by the cumbersome teleport Homer. Given the history of tension between the Dark Angels and the Space Wolves, Thane was pleased to see this automatic gesture on the part of Warfist. It made the black of the Space Marine's armor more than a gesture. They were functioning as a team. The creation of the Death Watch livery had struck a resonant chord in Thane's soul. He had seen an echo of the formation of the Last Wall, but that had been the coming together of chapters who were all Sons of Dawn. The Death Watch was something else again. He did not know if it was more profound or more meaningful. He did not try to guess at its consequences, though he knew they would be real and far-reaching. He had pondered whether he too would change the color of his armor. He had decided against it. He was part of the Last Wall, and its continued existence was necessary. It was about more than victory. It was about rebuilding. The Death Watch, he thought, was both simpler and more complex. It was the forging together of forces so disparate, in some cases so alien to each other, that loyalty to the Emperor was the only common bond. It did not exist to build, Thane thought, not in the same sense as the Last Wall, but as he travelled the darkness of the attack moon, the colours of his own armour almost as shadowy here as the black of his squad, he was part of the Death Watch blade. We do not stand guard, he thought. We are not the sentinels on the rampart. We watch only to find a moment to strike. We are destruction. They reached an intersection. The tunnel split into five paths. Thane stopped and consulted the Auspex. The energy reading was to the left of their position. Two of the paths looked promising. All had cables running down them. Since disembarking from the Penitent Roth, Thane had heard the heartbeat of the attack moon. It was deep and hard as a continent, irregular in its rhythm, yet colossal in its strength. It had grown much louder since they left the crevice. It boomed now, down all the tunnels. Dust shook from the roof of the passageway. There were other sounds, too. A clamour of bestial snarling, the clangs of heavy blows, the high-pitched squeals of the vermin-like creatures that swarmed in menial servility around the feet of the orcs.
"We should wait," Straton said. "For what?"
Warfist asked, his patience stretching taut.
"A frequency of traffic might point us to the correct route." "That's leaving things to chance at best," Warfist scoffed. "And wait how long? The success of the other two operations depends on us."
5 minutes, Thane said. 2 minutes passed. Corlin's voice came over Thane's helm box.
"Squad Gladius, this is Sword. What is your status?"
"Still searching."
"We have found the power source. Awaiting your action."
"Understood. What about the gate?"
"Squad Crozius is also in position."
"We will take the target shortly."
He vowed they would, even if he had to punch his way through the interior walls of the moon.
"Good. The Emperor protects."
"The Emperor protects."
In the 4th minute, brutish voices sounded closer in the far left passageway. Thane held up an arm, waiting a few seconds more. The noises came closer. The other paths were silent. Warfist was right. Straighten's surmise was barely more than a guess. But the direction of the tunnel was correct, and there was little else to go on. The bobbing glow of portable lamps appeared in the tunnel. Thane lowered his arm. Warfist shot forward, fists tight, arms extended, lightning claws at the ready. Thane and Straton followed, each with Gladius drawn. The kills had to be silent. Forcas and Abathur brought up the rear. Warfist rounded a curve in the tunnel. The voices became snarls of alarm. As Thane reached the curve, a shout was cut off, turning into a wet gurgle. He heard a sound like heavy bags of meat slapping against rock. He made the turn. Warfist was in the centre of a group of about a dozen orcs. Two lay dead. He had plunged into the centre of the greenskins and was fighting the largest. It was taller than Warfist, its head brushing against the roof of the tunnel. A huge wound gaped in its throat, and its jaws were wide in near-silent, choking fury. It swung a massive hammer at the Space Wolf. Warfist jabbed with his left claws, sinking them deep into the greenskin's arm at the elbow. He twisted. The greenskin's hand opened, nerveless. The hammer fell to the tunnel floor. A second later, so did the orc's lower arm. The other orcs charged the kill team. Thane pulled back his blade, then struck forward with server-weighted force. The gladius stabbed all the way through his target's throat and out the back of its neck. Thane slashed sideways. The orc's head, half-severed, lolled back. Blood geysered. The body fell. Thane leapt over it, grasped another orc by the face. The beast jerked back in surprise, and Thane yanked it forward. The greenskin chopped futilely at his armor with a heavy cleaver. Thane rammed the gladius into its chest. He angled the blow upward, drove the blade higher, cutting through gut and heart. Beside him, Straton took down two more orcs in swift, cold, precise strikes. A handful of others were still rushing forward. They were snarling in rage, and in their fury they were not shouting in alarm. Anger was the norm among orcs. Even if those snarls reached others, they would not pay attention, as they would to a summons. Abathar's plasma cutter burned through a pair of skulls. Warfist gutted the giant and turned back to impale the last of the attacking greenskins through the spine. That left the smaller, scuttling creatures. Their squeals were drowned out by the snarls of their masters. They fled, scrambling over the corpse of the monster, fast in their panic. Just a few meters ahead, Thane saw what looked like burrows in the stone. If the tiny xenoths reached those holes, they would be impossible to follow. He reached for his bolt gun, willing to risk the noise of concussion blasts. Forecast stepped forward, right hand outstretched, energy crackling from his psychic hood and down his arm. Lightning flashed from his fingertips. It struck the vermin and seared them to ash. There was a sharp crack of thunder. The smell of burned ozone filled the tunnel. The air rippled with the after effects of dissipating warp power. Warfist's wolf-headed helm turned from the smoking remains of the creatures towards Forcas. If he was disgusted by the Blood Angel sorcery, he refrained from saying so. "We have gained some time," Straton said, "but we have little to spare." "Agreed," said Thane. They moved quickly down the corridor. The pounding of machines and the violent discharge of energy grew louder, covering the sound of their boots as they ran. The tunnel twisted, then came to a stop. It opened into a huge cavern. From this position, Thane could see only a small portion of its upper reaches. Ahead was a rough metal ramp leading up to what appeared to be a massive promontory that jutted up and out into the space of the cavern. At the top of the promontory was a roofless structure. The tops of its walls were angular, as if it were a jagged iron crown. Energy coils rose from the corners, leaning out over the void. Innumerable cables ran from the base of the structure and into the air below the promontory, or down its slope into other tunnels opening up on the wall along its base. Some of the cables were as thick as land raiders. Searing light flashed from inside the structure. Energy arced and snapped from the coils. The booms of the discharges were deafening. In the gaps in the walls, figures moved back and forth, silhouetted by the pulsing light within. They were large. Their forms were strange, built up with something artificial that had the wrong shape for armor. There was activity up and down the ramp as hordes of the tiny greenskins hauled wagons of equipment up and loads of burned-out debris back down. The creatures were urged to greater efforts by orcs wielding shock prods. "A clear run to the top," Warfist said over the vox. Thane eyed the traffic on the ramp and agreed. These orcs were not a serious obstacle. "The alarm will be raised," he warned. "Our time will be limited." "What time we have will depend on Squad Crozius," said Straton. "The timing of all three squads is critical," Forcas said. "We must have faith in them, and they in us."
"For Terra and the Emperor, then," said Thane.
"For the Death Watch."
"For the Death Watch,"
the squad shouted, voices amplified by voxcasters. Warriors in black stormed out of the tunnel and up the ramp into the rising shriek of orcs.
"Ingenious," said the Blood Angel's tech marine, Gadriel. "Despite the damage the last wall inflicted, the orcs have managed to amplify the power of what remained."
"I've had more than enough of their ingenuity," said Iarios.
The ultramarine sergeant had led Squad Crozius to a small tunnel that ended 3 meters up from the floor of the gate chamber. Based on the reports of the first engagement, a large portion of the cavern must have fallen in. It was still well over a kilometer wide, but to the right of the kill team's position was a massive collapse. It looked as if a mountain had fallen on the machinery that powered the gate. Where there had been 3 titan-sized horns, now there was only 1, a monstrous patchwork that appeared to have been assembled from the wreckage of the previous 3. Its balance was precarious. Its upper half was thicker than the lower, and its peak was a colossal, trifurcated claw. Countless support chains now ran from the horn to the walls and slope of rubble. The horn trembled and vibrated from the energies fed to it and summoned by it. Eldritch light exploded and imploded in the center of the claw. Every time the burning force collapsed in on itself, there was a cave-filling flash on the platform at its base, and another war party of orcs appeared. "There is our primary target," said Gadriel. He pointed. To the left of the tunnel, an enormous power cable 6 meters thick entered the cavern. A short way to the right, it split into a myriad of smaller cables, running power to the hulking machines that in turn provided energy and direction to the functioning of the gate.
"They are vulnerable," said Valtar Skyclaw.
The Space Wolf Rune Priest looked up at the horn.
"The unclean energies here are on the cusp of overwhelming the material constraints. We will destroy this gate forever."
"Not until we claim its power source," Gadriel said.
"Aye,"
Skyclaw admitted.
"Where is Gladius?"
the Dark Angel Vehuel asked.
"Nearly in position," Iarios said.
Until the power was shut off temporarily, they could not attempt to splice into the main cable and link it to Gadriel's teleport Homer.
"How long will it take to cut into that?" asked Eligos, the second Blood Angel.
"Not long," said Gadriel.
"Attacking control center," Thane called over the vox.
"Stand by. Stand by."
Time accelerated and slowed at once. With Thane's call, the mission entered the narrow window of success. The timing of the actions required from all 3 squads came down to a matter of seconds. Sword and Crozius could not take their targets until the power flow was under the control of Gladius. Thane's squad would not be able to hold their position if Crozius did not stop the reinforcements from arriving. Crozius could not risk destroying the gate without also destroying its teleport Homer. The allotment of seconds crawled as Iarios took in the variables of the battlefield. He saw the vectors of action and their possible consequences. He waited, forced to guess at the moment and duration of Thane's success. So many unknowns. Theoretical? Action must be predicated on the known skill of allies. Practical? Attack at the opportune moment, based on the presumption of skill. He gave Thane a few more precious seconds. Then he leapt from the tunnel, leading Squad Crozius towards the main cable's junction. The moon's power plant was the size of a city. The cavern was so huge, Curlan could not make out the far walls. Haas brought Sword to an entrance on the floor of the cave. Her sense of how the shafts worked had been accurate, and the squad had moved quickly. They had encountered a few groups quickly dispatched of the dwarfish greenskins. Now the Death Watch was surrounded by generators larger than hab blocks. They were hulking machines, squat despite their height. It was impossible to see more than a few hundred meters in any direction. The generators sat at all angles on the cavern floor. The paths running between them were wide, but never straight for more than a few dozen meters. A tangled forest of cables ran between the generators. They trembled and convulsed with surges. Sparks flew from flawed junctions. Halos of lightning crackled down their lengths. The din was immense, a deep, continuous tremor that vibrated deep in Curlan's chest. The sound was so thick, it tried to stop his hearing. The sharp snap of energy cut through the tremor with a searing arrhythmia. The cavern rumbled and shrieked with the roars of beasts and the hiss of serpents. It rang with the endless grating choir of Xenos industry.
"There is power of a small sun here," Simias said as they paused at the entrance. "We cannot cut in blindly."
"And we come to steal this energy, not to destroy it," said Corland.
In the flashing gloom, orcs clambered up and down the generators. The energy production was so violent, every few moments Curran saw an electrocuted greenskin tumble from the heights of the machines.
"There are so many generators," Bepar said. "How can we let Gladius know which node to shut down for us?"
"We take the nearest," Simmias said. "Damage it, but do not destroy it."
Bepar turned to the ultramarine.
"That smacks of messy improvisation." "There is no perfection in this situation," Simmias told him. "The practical is constructed from the necessary."
"Improvisation, in other words," Bepar said.
Curran thought there was a glint of amusement in his tone. Thane's declaration of war came through the vox.
"We go now," Curran shouted.
Squad Sword raced towards the nearest generator. The laboring orcs saw the space marines and Haas and roared in surprise and rage. From the ground and from the scaffolding of the generators, they opened fire. The rain of bullets was disorganized. The aim was wild. Hakon Icegrip took the lead of the charge, ripping through orcs with frost blade and bolt pistol. He howled as he ran, the fury of his voice a terrifying, distorted rasp from his voxcasters, a monstrous cry at once animal and machine. The squealing orklings fled before him. Icegrip gave their masters no time to respond. He ploughed through an explosion of blood and flesh. Haas was not far behind him. She sprinted from enemy to enemy, her shock maul at full power, its blows immobilizing and burning the orcs before she finished them with auto-pistol rounds to their skulls. She was shouting, but Curran could make out no words. Her cries were a pure expression of vengeance and rage. She had returned to the moon to avenge a defeat and to purge her nightmares of the billions dead. Vepa moved in tandem with Curran. The Blood Angel used his bolter, cutting down orcs that tried to close in on the flanks of Icegrip and Haas. Vepa fired in precise short bursts. Every pull of the trigger counted. Where he looked, green skin heads burst apart. There was a careful art to his kills, a restrained wrath channeled into a perfection of aim, as if something worse were held in check by the force of discipline. Haniel and Simmias followed at a more measured pace. They were no less destructive, their bolter fire systematic. The run from the tunnel to the generator covered hundreds of meters in a single relentless burst of speed. As the squad approached the huge device, Simmias's fire turned from the orcs to the generator. He shot at the junction points on the near facade, blowing away cables. They fell, lashing back and forth. Haniel reached out for the orcs on the scaffolding. An eldritch storm bellowed over the generator. Two lightnings entwined and fought the warp against the materium. Orcs screamed, incinerated by the warring forces, their corpses dropping, falling to ash before they reached the ground. The generator was enveloped in coruscating power. The kill team reached the base of the generator, tore through its defenders, then rounded a corner. Ahead was a cable, twice Corlin's height.
"There," said Simmias. "That one."
"Thane," Curran voxed, "we have our target. Do you see it? Shut it down."
The orc engineers were ready for Gladius. Thane and Warfist burst across the threshold first. Three engineers faced them. They were large beasts, made even larger by the harnesses they wore. Power coils and portable generators rose from the greenskins' shoulders and backs like the arcing spines of saurians. The air around them shimmered. Static broke out across Thane's auto-senses as they reacted to an overload of energy. He had trouble focusing on the targets. Their image juddered, a cracking mosaic. His lenses fought to stabilize. He paused and fired. His shells exploded on contact with the orcs' force fields. Warfist snarled with frustration and rage. He hurled himself at the nearest engineer. The force field flared from the impact of the lightning claws, then collapsed with a deafening concussion. Warfist grappled with the orc. It struck him with a heavy tool that resembled a fusion of a shock maul and a plasma cutter. Electricity and flame washed over the Space Wolf's armor. The other two orcs came at Thane with similar weapons. He maglocked his bolt gun and raised his chainsword. He threw himself at the closest orc, using his mass and velocity against the barrier of the shield. He felt the resistance as an invisible force that pushed against him and stabbed through his armor and his body with powerful jolts. A vibrating numbness suffused his limbs. He pushed on, the chainsword sparking and shrieking. There was a blast, and his blade moved quickly again. He brought it down on the orc's skull and cut it in half before it could hit him with its weapon. Warfist punched through the shocks and flame and jammed his lightning claws through his opponent's throat. Before the third orc could attack either space marine, Abathar entered the control center and hit the beast with his power axe. Two energy fields collided. The interior of the center blazed with their fury. Then the axe blade broke through. It severed the largest of the orc's energy coils. The harness exploded, consuming the orc and hurling Abathar back out of the entrance. He was back in the next breath. Outside, Forkas and Straton held off the orc seeking to retake the center. The speed of the counterattack did not concern Thane. He had expected such a response as soon as Gladius had attacked. What worried him was its strength. The orcs already numbered more than 100. The choke point of the ramp and the lack of shelter gave the Death Watch an advantage, but two defenders would not be able to hold off the horde for long. Warfist lunged out of the doorway to join them. Corlan's report came over the Vox. "Sword is ready," Thane told Abathar. The Tech Marine nodded and approached the control surfaces of the center. They were crude and massive, like everything else fashioned by orcish hands, but Thane regarded them with more wariness than contempt. The power the orcs wielded belied the rough construction. "There is technology here that is beyond our own," he reminded himself. The controls were a conglomeration of huge, clumsy levers, switches, and buttons. They flashed with bursts of energy. Thane could not tell if the flares were overloads, short circuits, or if they were deliberate. Since the giant coils at each corner of the center gave off so much excess, it was as if the center were caught in a perpetual storm. Thane had no way to guess if the small blasts from the controls were by design or not. Beyond the control surfaces, there was no wall. The center was perched on the very edge of the promontory. Thane had a perspective of the entire power plant of kilometers of colossal linked generators. From this height, he felt as if he were looking into a cauldron of lightning. He could see no order to the construction. It seemed to be haphazard, machines piled atop machines, connections as superfluous as they were dangerous. How were these being a threat, he wondered? How had they not destroyed themselves? How could any of this work? How had it not blown up the instant it was activated? The questions multiplied, though he knew there would be no answers. The Mechanicus might know them, perhaps not. The answers did not matter. The action did. Seconds had passed since the death of the orc engineers. Thane contained his impatience as Abathar examined the controls. The seconds were precious, yet a mistake would be catastrophic. Abathar was cautious. His helmet moved back and forth as he scanned the controls. He touched nothing, though Thane sensed the speed of his evaluation. After a few moments, his attention focused on a section of the controls to the far left. He looked back and forth between the cavern and the technological jumble before him. "There," he said. He pointed to flames at the extreme left of the cavern. "That is a true fire." Thane looked. Abathar was right. The flickering light also suggested flames close to the ground. All the other flashes Thane could see came from no lower than the cables, midway up the flanks of the generators. "A generator in distress," Abathar said. He moved his hand to a switch. Just above it, sparks flew with a surprisingly steady rhythm. "That," the Dark Angel said, "is what passes for a remote alarm with these brutes." "You're sure?" "As sure as I must be." He flipped the switch. The sparks ceased. Exposed wiring glowed red, then went dark. "Sword, this is Gladius," Thane boxed. "We believe we have cut the power to your generator. Please confirm." "Confirmed," Corin said after a moment. "Splicing in." Thane turned to Abathar. "And the gate?" he asked. The Tech Marine had already moved to the other end of the control banks. "The machines grow brighter towards the right," he said. "There is a higher intensity of power gathering there. We must seek the greatest current." Thane looked off to the right, following the pattern of light. The flares converged at a blinding point that pulsed in and out of existence. "I see it," he said. "As do I. But it's not damaged. There appears to be a rough concordance between the position of the generators and their controls here.
A crude organization, perfect for these brutes.
These brutes who perform wonders we cannot hope to emulate, Thane thought. Even so, Abathar's logic was sound. The orcs combined brutishness and ingenuity in a manner that defied comprehension. It was necessary simply to accept the fusion and attempt to counter its effects. Abathar wrapped his gauntlet around a lever the size of a bolter. He nodded at Thane.
Crozius, Thane boxed, we are attempting to cut the power to the gate.
We are ready,
said Iarios. Abathar pulled the lever. It moved with a foul metallic grinding, as if the end of the shaft went all the way to the core of the attack moon. An ear-shattering klaxon sounded. Scores of crackling warning flares shot up from the consoles around the lever.
You have angered the orc machines, said Thane.
Good.
In the distance, the searing point dimmed to an ember, then went out.
The gate is closed,
Iarios shouted, triumphant.
The gate is closed!
Thane grinned. He imagined he could hear a howl coming from the throat of every orc on the moon as their device ceased to respond to their commands. He checked the clip on his bolter.
Now we wait on the others, he said. I'm sure you can convince the orcs to have patience, said Abathar.
He unshouldered the teleport homer and extended its mechadendrites. His servo arm's plasma cutter sliced open a portion of the control surface, exposing a madness that Thane could barely qualify as technological. Abathar began linking the homer to the madness.
On what basis can we expect that to work? Thane asked.
On faith,
Abathar answered. The Mechanicus has made this a human device, but the taint of the Xenos remains. On this day, that taint is necessary. It will permit the union of the homer to the Greenskin network.
Then you have my faith and my hope, Thane said. The Emperor protects. The Emperor protects.
Thane clapped Abathar on the pauldron and made for the door. Outside the control center, a green wave surged towards the ramp. Iarios fired his bolter in a wide repeating arc. Greenskin chests and skulls burst apart, bodies fell on bodies. A mound of corpses grew. He timed his kills carefully.
Theoretical, each foe killed at the right moment becomes a new obstacle to the others.
Already, he had created a protective wall of flesh taller than a man, blocking the left hand and forward approaches to Squad Crozius's position. Behind him, Gadriel had cut into the housing of the giant cable. Where it began its branching into the smaller lines, it was connecting the mechadendrites of the modified teleport homer. The device would draw upon multiple branches of power.
How long?
Iarius called out.
Nearly there.
On the right, Vehuel and Eligos added to the wall of bodies. Skyclaw stood atop the mound, the center of a shrieking storm. Winds flattened the orcs as they struggled to close with the kill team. Lightning struck them down when they dared to attack the rune priest. His axe blade shone a brilliant, frigid blue. Ice flew on the wind, sharp as steel, lacerating flesh, slashing faces. Orcs staggered on the top of the mound, blinded by ice shards. They screamed, holding their eyes. Blood poured from between their fingers. Iarios did not waste shells putting those brutes down. When they came within Skyclaw's reach, he decapitated them with a single, wrathful stroke of his runic axe.
A grand battle!
Skyclaw shouted.
Son of Gilliman, you have led us to a rare feast.
We will avenge the dead of Ulanor yet, said Eligos.
By the will of the Emperor,
Iarios said. Yet he felt the pressure of passing time. The gate was dark, and the orcs' attention was divided by the simultaneous attacks on three fronts. The squads were benefiting, Iarios thought, from the uncertainty over which target was the most important, the most vulnerable. The orcs were fighting blindly, for the moment without the direction that had made them so lethal on Ulanor. But the confusion would pass, and they were still mustering ever greater numbers of reinforcements. Greenskins poured out of every tunnel entrance. They converged on Crozius at a run. They died on the near approach. For now, Iarios calculated his team was at the edge of what it could hold off, and once Gadriel's task was complete, they would be facing a much greater flood of the enemy.
Done, said Gadriel. Let us bear witness now to the will of the Omnisire.
Thane,
Iarios foxed, let the current flow.
The orcs were concentrating their fire now. With sword no longer moving, the attacks were becoming more and more focused and savage. Desperate, too, Courland wanted to believe. He wanted the orcs to know doom was rushing for them. He wanted them to know fear. He wanted them to know fate had turned its back on them at last. Simmias had cut through a slab of the generator's shielding. While he spliced the teleport Homer into the inner workings of the machine, Courland, Vepa, and Huss held the ground attacks off. Ice Grip had climbed up to the cable network. The lines were thick enough to walk on, and he raced over the network, taking down the orc gunners. Xenos blood rained on the cavern floor. Bodies hailed down upon their kin. Haniel's warp lighting lashed out again and again, burning more of the greenskins above. And still, the enemy fire became more and more focused. Solid rounds pounded against Corlan's armor. Some of the rounds were large enough, the hits direct enough, to punch through the ceramite. He blinked off the damage warnings. There was no shelter and nowhere to go until the task was done. Halsey's armor was shattered over her chest and shoulders, though she still had her helmet. She kept moving, dodging from one end of the squad's position to the other. Her shouts had become a raspy snarl. Her breath was pained. Her shots counted, though. She fought with the purpose of a warrior certain of her death, and as certain that she would take the enemy down with her.
"Now!"
Simmias shouted.
"Now!" Courland repeated into the vox. "Thane, it must be now!"
"Turn the power back on," Thane voxed to Abathar. The roar of the attacking orcs was too great for him to make himself heard otherwise. He did not look back. Standing above Forcas, Straighten and Warfist, he sprayed bolter shells down the ramp into the rising tide. The four space marines killed the greenskins by the score, but the tide still grew. The orcs charged over heaps of bodies. There were thousands of them massing at the base of the ramp, the press of the mob pushing them on. Their horde was so dense, it pushed even the dead forward. There would be no retreat through the tunnels. Squad Gladius slowed the orcs. Each second was a victory, Thane thought. Each second might be the victory. The orcs did not engage in massed fire, wary of destroying the center they had come to save. If they had, Gladius would have already lost. There was a huge flash behind Thane. For a moment, the ramp and its combatants were lit in negative colors.
"Power restored," Abathar reported. "The devices are charging."
The gate burst into life. A foul captive star blazed in the grip of a horn. It vanished, and an emerald explosion on the platform released a mob of heavily armored orcs and a tank into the cavern. The tank had a massive spiked siege blade. It thundered off the platform in a cloud of black promethium smoke. Its hulking silhouette bristled with guns. Iarios saw it battle across cavern floor and knew the mission strategy had become desperate.
"If they start using heavy armor," said Vehuel, "they may be willing to sacrifice what we have seized,"
Iarios finished. The tank's blade struck the wall of bodies. The rampart was taller than a space marine now. It toppled forward, a carrion wave. Skyclaw turned towards the vehicle. The storm gathered around him. It surrounded him with a gleaming, whistling shroud of razor ice. He shot his arms forward, and the storm screamed with all its concentrated strength into the tank. Ice slashed through every gap in the armor, tore the plating, and shredded the crew. The tank swerved, out of control. Its turrets still barked. A shell slammed into Skyclaw. It hurled him from the remains of the corpse wall. He hit the cavern floor with such force he cracked stone. The storm died. The Space Wolf's icon blinked an ominous amber in Iarios's helm display. The tank was still moving. Iarios ran forward, his bolter on full auto bursts. He held the gun in one hand, with the other he unclipped a frag grenade. He jumped up the fallen wall, hurled the grenade through a rent in the armor. The cab of the vehicle exploded. Torn bodies flew out of it. The tank rode over the wall and then stopped. A new obstacle. The gate flashed again. More orcs appeared, and more tanks. A snarl erupted from a voxcaster. It was a sound that began as something vaguely human, rising until it became a monstrous shriek of hunger. It was nothing but need, a drive that was beyond human, beyond animal. At first, Iarios thought he was hearing the wolf howl of Skyclaw, but the space wolf had not moved. The sound came from Elegos. The Blood Angel had left his position to the right of Gadriel. He tore over the ground towards the nearest group of orcs. They were racing to finish off Skyclaw, who had risen to his knees. Elegos pounded past the space wolf, chainsword drawn. He plunged into the orc's blade, roaring. He did not fight as he had before. Gone was the elegant exactitude of his violence. He was worse than a butcher. His blows were savage, careless, lethal. The roaring from the voxcaster cut off as he shed his helmet. His face was contorted. It was a rictus, his teeth bared as if they would devour hunger itself. Elegos was not rescuing Skyclaw, but his whirlwind of violence blunted the orc's attack long enough for Skyclaw to regain his feet, lift his bolt pistol, and shoot back. Iarios and Gadriel rushed to his position. Behuel moved in more slowly, maintaining a wide field of fire, cutting back at the advance of the horde for another second and another second. Iarios stood at Skyclaw's side, blasting at the enemy. Gadriel ran to Elegos. The tech marine called to his brother, shouting his name over and over. Elegos did not respond. He tore the orcs apart. The tide closed in on all of them, a constriction of foul smell, brutal muscle, drooling fangs, and misshapen blades. A vibrating chain axe cut into Iarios's flank. He spun into the hit, firing as he turned. The stream of mass-reactive shells pulped the features of his attacker and the orcs on either side. Gadriel blinded one orc after another with his plasma cutter. He called and called his brother's name in vain. Iarios did not understand the nature of the frenzy that had taken Elegos, but at this stage he almost welcomed it. The Blood Angel fought with such reckless fury he was forcing another small pause on the orc advance. Iarios stood back to back with Skyclaw, a wall of huge green brutishness before them. The rune priest's breathing on the vox was ragged. The readout of his life signs was still flashing amber. The teleportation device was still charging. A hum filled the cavern. It was gargantuan. It was in the walls, the floor, the air. The entire moon vibrated. A terrible song was coming into being. Soon it would have a voice. "A few moments more," Gadriel voxed. "A few..." Light. Light of breaking, of dissolution, of shattering, of edges, of fragmentation. The end of here and the end of there. Death of space, death of time. Death. Light of breaking. Light of breaking. All broken. Corland gasped. Blood filled his mouth and his lungs. He was standing in the center of the teleportation platform of the Herald of Night. Haas was on her hands and knees, shaking with enough force to fracture bone. All the squads were present. The other space marines seemed as unsteady on their feet. He had never experienced a teleportation like it. He had been ripped into nothing, then reassembled, and every particle of his being remembered the pain of destruction and rebirth. Between the two lay an infinitesimal portion of a second that was as wide as aeons. The hum was still growing. He could feel it even this far from the moon, through the hull of the strike cruiser. He commanded his body to move. It obeyed with reluctance. With limbs of crumbling rockcrete, he walked from the teleportation platform. By the time he and his brothers reached the bridge, he could run again. In the oculus, the moon was still there. The homers had functioned as Kubik had promised. They had locked onto the sensors in the armor and transported the tiny mass of the Death Watch kill teams before they had gathered the full power needed to send the orc base out of the sector. "Why has it not gone?" Haas whispered. Her teeth chattered. She did not yet have control over her body.
"It will. We are victorious,"
Kulin said this even as he watched the explosions of the Void War. Nothing was finished. But the teleporters worked. They were working. They had triumphed. Staring at the moon, Simias said, "That is unexpected." The mountains, canyons, and plains of the Orc base were suffused with a shifting, retina-slashing glow. And they were moving. The mountains rocked back and forth. Peaks collapsed in on themselves. The canyons of iron pulled wide, the crust of the moon tearing like flesh. The plains heaved as if inconceivable leviathans were struggling to the surface.
"What is happening?" said Corland.
Simias shook his head.
"The theoreticals of the technology do not account for this. The disassembly of the material body is instantaneous."
"It didn't feel like it," said Haas.
"This geometric distortion is abnormal."
"Shipmaster,"
Atnakiel said,
"pull us back."
Simias said,
"There is no distance we can reach. Our fates have already been decided."
"The Emperor protects,"
said Vepar.
"The Emperor protects,"
Corland repeated. He barely heard his own voice. He watched the vast agony take the moon. He saw dissolution approach. "We have done this to you," he thought. "We have ended you. We are victorious." There had been few triumphs in this war. If this was his last one, he would enjoy it. The end came first as a brilliance that consumed the spectrum. Corlin's lens shutters slammed down, but not fast enough. He saw the absolute light still. The shutters opened again and let him see the moon's end. Half the sphere had vanished. What remained looked like a skull cut cleanly along a diagonal line. That form held just long enough for Corland to understand what he was seeing. Then it erupted. A swarm of asteroids hurtled through the void. The shattered surface tore through the warring ships. He had begun coming to the Cerebrium again. Mesring did not let any of the other High Lords know. They did not come because of what they feared to see. They hid from the light of the Orc Moon under the cracked dome of the Great Chamber. Mesring came to see the very thing that kept them away. The top of the Widdishin's tower pierced the clouds more often than any other point of the inner palace. Mesring was confident of being alone here and of being able to contemplate the moon. He saw the flash. Suddenly, there was an impossible shape in the heavens. Then it flew apart. Mesring gaped. He stared. His mind was blank except for an inchoate horror. The great light faded. Where the moon had been was a sudden blackness, the return of the void. Smaller flashes and glints surrounded the absence where the moon had been. Some of the glints grew stronger. They became more consistent. Their number grew. He understood nothing. He was bearing witness to a transcendent death, and his thought could not encompass it. He stood at the casement, his body numb, all his awareness focused on a point hundreds of thousands of kilometers away. The points came closer. The glints became shards of white light. Still, he did not understand. He stayed where he was, fear and horror and helpless anger combining in an alchemy of madness. He was standing there, blank, lost, when the fragments of the moon entered Terra's atmosphere and the night caught fire. The bones of the attack base fell on Terra. Flaring molten red from their descent through the atmosphere, they hammered the continental expanse of the Imperial Palace. Where there was night, titanic explosions created day. Where there was day, millions of tons of ash and dust blanketed the sky and brought down a rain of night. Sectors the size of hive cities vaporized. Millions looked up in the final seconds of their lives and saw the mountains of iron and stone come for them. Millions upon millions more knew nothing. They moved through their entombed lives, far from any view of the sky, ignorant until the blow, the fire, the cathedrals turned to ash, the towers crushing fall. Shockwaves annihilated ramparts. Winds, hundreds of kilometers an hour, raged outward from the craters. Firestorms were 100 kilometers wide. The dead at impact were fortunate in their ignorance of their momentary horror before oblivion. The victims of flame and wind and burial knew terror. Death came to them with great fear and pain. Victory was choking, burning, suffocating, dying. Victory was the most terrible destruction for 1,000 years. The greater meteor swarm spared the precincts of the inner palace. Small fragments fell closer, pulverizing roofs. They slashed the night with streaks of fire. One struck the Widdishin's tower a glancing blow, shattering the plexiglass windows of the cerebrium. The big strikes fell beyond Mesring's view of the horizon. The huge fragments vanished, and then he saw the awful sunrises of fireballs. The glow of devastation was the hammer blows of a wrathful god. Then the wind and the dust came for him, reaching into the cerebrium with a furnace blast. He screamed then. The hand of the beast itself had come to claim him. He fell to the chamber floor, abandoned to a monstrous transcendence. He was not found for 2 days. Even then, he was still screaming.